Before we begin the show, let's get something straight. Mennonites are a Protestant group based around church communities that don't believe in war and violence, and some, but not all, of Mennonites live autonomously in farm and rural areas with very little use for technology. Got it? Okay, now, Mennonites live in similar communities and have very little use for technology. Also, the Mennonites are not a real group, but a play on words for going off the grid. I'm Jabulani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, we meet Eric Brindy, an MIT student who became a so-called Mennonite and lived a minimalist life for 18 months in an off-the-grid community. He says he's better off for it, and that's the name of his book, Better Off. We'd like to know from you, Kansas City, what technological or modern luxury you've given up that makes you feel as if you're better off. That's on Central Standard after this hour's NPR News. City, independence and self-reliance are hallmarks of the American cultural identity. But we live lives where food can be delivered to our homes and information pours into our palms in limitless quantities. Has this made us better? Have machines, computers, and technologies afforded us the luxuries of leisure and fulfillment? Or have they made us slaves to their attainment? This is Central Standard. I'm Jabulani LaFall. Today's guest, like many who seek the answers to these essential questions in our modern world, sought to answer those questions on his own. And we welcome that guest, Eric Brindy. He's the author of the book, Better Off, Flipping the Switch on Technology. Eric Brindy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, why did you decide to go off the grid? That's the first essential question.
Well, actually, when I was in my early teens, I was an ardent fan of technology. I'd say that Star Trek was by far my most favorite television show. And later on in my teens, when I got a job playing the piano at a French restaurant, and by the way, piano was my other big thing, I would smuggle in the theme from Star Trek in along with the Chopin and the Debussy, and people would stop what they were doing, and they'd say, "What is that? I've heard that before. Is that Debussy?" And I kind of get a little chuckle out of it. But anyway, I was such a fan of Star Trek that I just ate, lived, and breathed it all the time. But somewhere in between my early teens and when I got to be a sophomore in college, I went through a full reversal. I don't know the exact date that it happened, but I know one seed of doubt was planted when, maybe when I was 13 or 14, a close relative got one of the first word processors ever made. I know this dates me a little.
What is a word processor?
It was a giant thing, and it had the label Brother on it, and it weighed about 35 pounds. And anyway...
Big Brother.
Well, that's what I've come to think.
Right.
But what I noticed was that this person... Well, the whole point of the device, right, was to save the time and trouble of writing and make it go a lot faster and easier. And this person spent so much time with that device, it was like I never saw him again. So I think the seed of the notion was planted in my head that maybe these time and labor-saving devices don't actually save us time. Maybe they actually gobble up our time. And there is even I know there's a word for that now. It's called time suck. You know, you sit down at a computer, and then you look up the clock, and it's 6 hours later, and you have no idea where the time went.
If there's time suck, that means that for a lot of people, time sucks. But when did you decide to actually go off the grid? When did that seed of doubt about technology sprout to the point where you were like, I can't take this anymore? Was it during your years at MIT, which is a case study in irony?
Well, actually, I went to MIT in order – before I went to MIT, I was already pretty much anti-technology. And so when I went there, I really went in order to infiltrate the technological establishment in order to do my part to overthrow it. I think the pivotal moment may have come that you're looking for when – on one of my trips back and forth between MIT and Kansas, where I grew up, I saw a man with a big black wide-brimmed hat on a Greyhound on the bus, and when we got off at a rest stop, I sidled up to him and wanted to get to know him. I was curious what he was about, and I figured he was from one of the Amish groups in Pennsylvania.
It wasn't Johnny Cash.
well, I don't think so. So anyway, one thing led to another. He got my address. I got his address. And before I knew it, I was setting up a stay with this group. And it turned out that they were from one of the strictest old order communities in the country. They're related to the Amish, but even stricter. And in my book, I call them Minimites. Most Amish will use a lot of motorized equipment, contrary to popular perception. So many Amish will use chainsaws and gasoline-powered pumps, and some even have their whole houses outfitted with outlets that they can plug in. They're not electric outlets. They're pressurized air outlets that allow them to power appliances the way we do, only using pressurized air instead of electricity. But this group, it turned out, banned all motorized devices whatsoever, and also motorized vehicles, which most Amish do. So that meant that they did everything by hand or with horsepower. And I was extremely intrigued to see what it would be like. So that ended up becoming my field work, so to speak, as an MIT graduate student.
And how did you eventually involve your wife in this process, Mary?
Right. Well, once I was sure that I'd hooked Mary, after we proposed and I got her partway along, I sprang this idea on her. And at first, she was a little taken aback. And by the way, she was working as an accountant, a full-time accountant in downtown Boston at the time. And her main exposure to nature was a potted plant that was in her office. Well, I struck a deal with her. I said, I mean, she was very skeptical at first, but I gradually persuaded her. And I struck a deal with her by saying that after we spent a year and a half with this group, that she would get the deciding vote of where we'd move next.
And that's a pretty good deal for such an adventure.
Yeah, yeah. I think I came out pretty well.
What made you then want to chronicle your travails and sojourns in the wild, so to speak, in an Amish Mennonite community, as you call it? What made you want to chronicle those in the book that's called Better Off, Flipping the Switch on Technology? What made you want to share that story?
Well, I always liked writing, and I didn't really have a plan to write a book when I was there. We just kind of arrived. But through some contacts, I ended up writing a series of articles for a magazine that's now defunct. It was a Back to the Land kind of magazine. But after amassing a number of articles there that were like journal entries of our experience, then they seemed to need to coalesce into something bigger, and so they became this book.
Tell us about your experience in this community of Mennonites. Tell us how it struck you when you first got there.
Well, I will say it was very easy to romanticize it from afar. And, you know, having glowing, rosy-colored images of myself and Mary out in the fields and throwing bales of hay over our shoulders and what have you. But in the last few miles as we approached the location, and it's a secret location that I agreed not to divulge when I wrote the book. They knew I was possibly going to write about them. images came into my head that were very different, and I think the source may have been Monty Python and the Holy Grail, which was my only other cultural or media-inspired exposure to rustic living. And in that, the image that came to my head was of peasants gnarled fingers stooped over in the muck, trying to dig out turnips with their bare fingers. and somebody standing by trying to indoctrinate them with Marxian doctrines. And I looked over at my wife as we were driving, and I looked at her wonderful, her lovely ivory hands, and I thought, what is going to become of those hands? What is going to become of us? Is this marriage even going to last the first month? But now the irony, though, is when we got there, it turned out to be in many ways even better. This is the weird thing, even better than the romanticized image I had in my head, and the bad image completely vanished. It's hard to explain in a few words, and that's why it took me a whole book to describe it, of course. But there is a phrase that these people, whom I call the Mennonites again, use time and again, which was, many hands make work light. There's something almost magical about it. You get together with these people, and maybe you barely know them, and maybe they're stony-faced, sober people dressed in solid colors, and you start to work, and somehow, over time, as you're working, you forget about the work, and you begin to enjoy each other's company. You have a conversation, and you're enjoying the out-of-doors, especially, of course, if it's nice weather. And it becomes a kind of symphonic experience with many different layers. The work serves as kind of a rhythm and a bass section. And then the fellow feeling with your fellow workers is kind of like the harmony. And the conversation is like the melody. And then you have the backup music provided by the birds and the breeze. And it's that's the kind of imagery that I came up with in my book, because I'm a musician. There's a musical metaphor that keeps cropping up.
And to describe it in your own words, there's a passage in your book where you say, it was as if the field were there to harvest us, not we it. The whole undertaking, a pretext, a cosmic matchmaker's ruse. Can you elaborate on that very literary description of your life in this remote farm community?
Well, yeah. The question is, are you there to grow vegetables on the farm, or is the farm growing you? And is this what we're missing in industrial society? Are we cut off by cutting ourselves off from the earth? Do we cut ourselves off from the kind of fertile ground that we need to grow and thrive? And I would say that, yes, in a sense, that's true, because we're missing the many-layered, many-textured kind of experience that you can only get when you're really close to nature and using your own muscles to do what you need to do to get through the day. And we have layers and layers of technology that insulate us from that and create, almost starve us from the reality that we need to enjoy life.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Our guest is Eric Brindy, the author of the book Better Off, Flipping the Switch on Technology. He spent about 18 months on a remote farm living a minimalist lifestyle. Speaking of which, Kansas City, what piece of technology would you be willing to give up that you think would make your life better or make you better off? Ironically, we'll be asking you to tell us this through something called the telephone. 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. There's also that fabled website, Facebook, and Twitter, where you can tell us how you would shun technology at KCURCST. Email is also an option at centralstandard@kcur.org. Put on your thinking caps and tell us, what technology are you willing to give up that you think would make your life better? Once again, that number is 816-235-2888. Now, in this book, Better Off, Flipping the Switch on Technology, Eric, you study the social impacts of technology history. And so what has been the social impact of technology history from where you sit now, having been on the farm and having reintegrated yourself back into modern society? What's the social impact of technology?
Well, there's two kind of contradictory sides to it. You know, on the one hand, there's definitely a place for technology. Even cavemen had technology. Even some insects, they've discovered some insects have a certain kind of technology where they use little twigs or things to build with and so forth. So technology is an inextricable part of life. And that's why my book is called Better Off Flipping the Switch on Technology. It doesn't say better off getting rid of technology. It's about finding the right switch-off point. How much do you really need? And that's what frames the quest.
You say in your book that technological advancements have created artificial demands for fuel, space, money, and time. Talk about that idea. What's so artificial about our modern wants?
Well, I think about a famous line from Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the French philosopher, even way back in the 1700s, who could say that all of the amenities and niceties and refinements of his affluent, you know, upper crust French culture became chains because they created new needs. And when you have a new need, it fulfilling that need no longer makes you happy. All that it does is keep you from being unhappy. So you constantly raise the bar of what it takes to be happy. There's another author who uses the phrase the hedonic escalator, that you take a step up materially, but it keeps bringing you back down again. And so you have to keep stepping up just to maintain that the level of happiness, just to maintain a level of happiness.
A sort of technological hedonism, so to speak.
Right. But it's like you can never really find full satisfaction if you go down that route. When you're talking about artificial needs, now there are actual real needs that we have, and I think you can distinguish the two. I think we have certain needs. We have a need for companionship. We have a need for, well, the basic needs. We have food, shelter, clothing. But companionship, I think we have a need for a raw experience of nature in the sense that our muscles need to feel physical resistance and things like that.
What are the critical artificial needs and wants that you feel have crippled us as a society subsequent to the advent of technology? What are some of the critical artificial wants and needs?
I think maybe the most damaging and destructive one is the need for the automobile. Before the automobile existed, nobody ever, you know, complained about not having a car. And now, since we live in a society in which the infrastructure is completely built up around the presupposition of this car, it's almost impossible for many people to live without a car. And yet, look at all the damage the car is doing. It's depriving you of exercise that you would otherwise get if you were walking or biking to your destination. It's filling the world with greenhouse gases and other pollutants and killing the planet. And it's also taking up an extraordinary amount of time. If you add up all of the time that people spend per day in a car, it has been calculated to be 2 hours a day. But then you also have to calculate the cost of paying for the car. That's another hour or so a day.
That's an interesting thing that I myself have considered with no automobile myself. And there's an interesting stat out there. We spend 6 months of our entire life, 6 months, a full 30-day increment, 6 months, half a year, stopped at red lights.
Yeah, I can believe it.
Let's go to Phil. Phil, welcome to Central Standard.
Hey, Eric, nice to talk to you. I'm actually someone who has, sort of a long-ago tenuous connection with you. I'm not sure if I actually ever wrote you a letter, but I know that you were probably in contact with a couple of good friends of mine here up in Jefferson County, Kansas, who have been in touch with you through the years. And I think I probably even have some copies of Kayla Met Tara somewhere in a box. I think that's the magazine maybe that you wrote.
Oh, are you the Phil who has partnered with a guy in Pumpkins and Cider? Or Cider?
No, that's not me.
Oh.
But like-minded folks around here up in Jefferson County that are doing stuff like that. So.
Okay.
But at any rate, ironically, as I was talking to your screener before I got on, and then as I turned the radio off and listened over the phone, you were talking about automobiles. And I've had a long-time hate-hate relationship with my automobiles. And my wife and I actually have a small farm up here in Jefferson County. We live in a rural area. It's obviously not terribly remote up here, but one of the decisions that we made – month or so ago, and actually just in the process of sort of listing today, is that we are going to spend a year experimenting with running our farm without a truck.
Wow.
For all of the reasons that you were just saying, the amount of resources, it sucks out of our, you know, economic bottom line, and the repairs and the gasoline and the insurance and all those different things. And for me, it's really a matter of you know, trying to distance myself from the technology. I think my wife, it's more, how can we get some more income coming into our you know, pocketbooks? But I think that, you know, making steps like that and you know, the end result of that is that there's going to be more work to do, you know, sort of physical work to do to make up for that in some ways. And, you know, I guess if I had a question to ask you, you know, you were talking about the community and the many hands make light work. I think in the 10 or so years that I've been up here farming, the most difficult challenge that we have had in taking advantage of all of the resources that we potentially have on this farm is that there's just not enough people here to do the work. And to the, you know, the community is far-flung and loosely affiliated up here in Jefferson County. We have a lot of like-minded people who are interested in, you know, becoming Mennonites, you know, and many of us are working on that, but there is no community of effort. And so as I think about, you know, what the implications of getting rid of a truck are and how much more, you know, physical work I will need to do hauling firewood and water and things like that, how do you begin really getting communities established or changing that culture so that it's possible to become Mennonite when it's an appropriate choice to make?
Thank you, Phil, for your question. And Phil from Oskaloosa is considering getting rid of his truck. Kansas City, what are you considering getting rid of to make your life better? What piece of technology would you get rid of and think you would be better off as a result of? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also write in at centralstandard@kcur.org. Address Phil's question in terms of achieving a balance in a community that's willing to get down in the soil and do the work, even if you are.
Well, I will say, Phil, that for us, we had it easy when we lived with the Mennonites because we were surrounded by like-minded people, and we very, very nearly stayed with them. We actually bought land, and one of the plot points of the book that I don't want to reveal is why we ended up in the end selling the land and moving to the city. But if you have the luxury of being near an old order community, even if you don't join formally, many of them are very happy to interact with like-minded outsiders. In fact, I think it bolsters their sense of doing the right thing to find people who aren't of their religion doing something similar. We ended up switching guns, so to speak, and moving right into the heart of the city. Now, you might wonder, how can that be a low-tech way of life? Well, weirdly enough, in some ways, everything you just talked about that you're looking for is much more accessible in a city because you have a higher, much higher population density, and especially if you're in an older part of the city where there's a lot of old houses that need rehabbing, you get a lot of urban pioneers or urban householders. I consider myself an urban householder. And best of all, the transportation problem is solved because everything's so close together. So we don't need to own a car in inner city St. Louis. We bike. All my kids grew up biking everywhere. Now they are very adept at biking and sometimes taking the Metrolink, which is a light rail system in St. Louis. And they can go around and visit their friends all over St. Louis, and I don't have to chauffeur them, and neither does my wife, and it's very freeing. And I have a good friend that we collaborate on projects with. And you're right, it's very devastating if you don't have this kind of community in proximity. It's hard to do it all by yourself. In times when I've had to slave through a project just by myself without help, that's almost been a penance.
Our guest is Eric Brindy, the author of the book, Better Off Flipping the Switch on Technology. Kansas City, how far have you lived off the grid, and what was the experience like for you? We hesitate to say call in, but that's what you need to do. 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org to tell us what technology you'd give up that you think would make your life better. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we're back on the grid to discuss how Eric Brindy adjusted to returning to modern life and the lessons he brought back with him from the farming community. Central Standard returns in a moment. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. After stints at the University of Kansas and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or MIT, our guest today had enough of the complex life of thought at the speed of light. So he flipped the switch for 18 months and has a new outlook on modern technology as a result of living in a remote farm community. Our guest is Eric Brindy, the author of the book Better Off, Flipping the Switch on Technology. And we want to know, Kansas City, if you don't want to get off the grid, what piece of technology would you be willing to give up that you think would make your life better? Ironically, we're asking you to call in on a phone. 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. And if you haven't gone off the grid quite yet, tweet us at KCURCST. Facebook is also an option. And our email address is centralstandard@kcur.org. A discussion about minimalist technology, using all the technology at our disposal to keep this conversation going. You were off the grid for 18 months, Eric Brindy. What made you say, okay, that's it, back to society?
Well,
what were the factors?
Well, it's kind of complicated. And as I mentioned in my book.
Simplify.
all right. Well, I'm trying to say something without giving away the main turning point in the plot of the book. But I would say, all right, one of the huge factors for us was that we were living in a county that was, I would say, I don't know what the word was. It was not an intellectually vibrant county. And there's a part of myself that's maybe too intellectual, maybe even hyper-intellectual because I spent too much time in school. But like it or not, I developed an artificial need for a certain kind of intellectual conversation, and I couldn't get that there. And that was, I felt a little bit starved for that. And so one of the wonderful things about living in the city is that I have a few close friends that I can get together and, you know, talk to, you know, over a beer. And they're very, you know, the access is much easier than in the country. In the country, somebody like that, I might have had to go 25 miles to find somebody like that. So that's one reason.
That's one of the biggest overriding reasons.
Right. And then also, I have a great love for music. I was trained in classical piano. And in St. Louis, my wife and I on a tandem bicycle can bike 2 miles to Powell Symphony Hall and hear the St. Louis Symphony. And because, oh wait, I can't reveal this, but we have, well, I guess I can reveal this. I have a friend who gets free tickets to a lot of performances and he often can't use them. So we even get his free tickets so we can afford to do it on our low budget.
What was the hardest part about rejoining modern society?
Oh, well, everything. I mean, because you're going against the grain. You have the traffic. You have the noise. You have the attitude of a lot of people that of not in my backyard or that I am an island unto myself. And I've made the mistake a few times of assuming that other people would be as interested in bartering or trading favors as I would, and it really kind of rubs some people the wrong way if you make that assumption.
What did you learn about yourself in the farming community and both being in metropolitan areas such as Boston and St. Louis? What are the things that keep most of us attached to our machines? What are the main things?
I really think that probably the number one thing is socialization. We're socialized into a certain level of technology. It's a social need first, and an individual need second. Because the society has made it, incorporated it into the infrastructure, it becomes everybody's need. And that's really the trickiest part. I think if you can somehow become amphibious and learn how to give what society expects from you to some degree, which we do, but then keep another leg in a simpler way of life in the city. That's the trick.
I thought you were going to say if you learn to live underwater and on land, you'll be good. But
something like that, yeah. Well, under technological deep waters, and then but keep one foot on the green earth.
Culturally amphibious.
Yes.
Ron in Kansas City, Missouri, welcome to Central Standard.
Yeah, I was wanting to make the comment of how we can use technology better, and that technology can make things better for individuals if we try to interact what we know about being human beings and what the technology does to us. And the example I have is that in creating communities, we are able on the internet to create those communities and specialize in interest in those communities that grew in a very expansive way today. That it's forming, but it's not forming at high levels of discussion, I think.
What would you be willing to give up, Ron, to use technology better?
I'm kind of in a future shock type of thing. It's kind of like I'm overwhelmed with the amount of information that is available, you know, from all directions. And I think that, we as Americans take on the world problems. So, I'm not willing too much to give up anything. I want improvement of that. For example, I think that we could form a government. We should have a government internet system that is educating the people on the problems that are taking place throughout the world, rather than just getting in the piecemeal way that we get it over the internet. You know, put it in some type of connective form so people can get a handle on it, rather than just bombarded about this problem, this problem, this problem, this problem, this problem, this problem. And that's the way we're getting into, which is creating a lot of confusion in people's minds.
Ron, there's something similar to that on the internet right now. I can tell you it's called npr.org and kcur.org.
Mm. Well,
thank you, Ron. He doesn't want to give up anything. Like many Americans, I can't say that I want to give up anything is sort of the maxim you hear when you talk about living with less or doing more with less.
Well, to try to address Ron's point when he talks about the good side of technology, maybe this brings me back to my point about being amphibious. I do concede that there can be good uses even for the internet. And even if there aren't, there's so many other people are using it that I do feel obliged to use it at times. So even though I don't have the internet at home, we're three blocks from a library, and I can go over there and sign up for an hour time slot and do some emails with people who are mostly used to do that sort of communication and maybe do some research, especially since now most of the other ways to do research are much harder because of the internet.
Let's go to Judy in Overland Park. Judy, welcome to Central Standard.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm great.
Good. My answer to a lot of this is to have never gotten involved in the first place.
Whoa.
We'll start at the beginning. I don't have a washer and dryer. I do go to a laundromat, so it's not that I don't have access to a washer and dryer. I don't have a television because a few years ago, they wanted everyone to switch to either cable or either buy a box, get cable, or do, what was the other one, a satellite, and I didn't make that switch over. But then I don't have a cable bill. I don't worry about that bill every month. I don't have a computer, therefore I don't have the internet, but I also don't have that bill. And I have no cell phone. I don't understand why anyone would want to be connected 24 hours a day to whoever wants to call or send messages in that way. And I often get into conversations with people. People now are mystified. They don't understand because I do have to travel because I'm not from this part of the country. So I go home and they ask me, well, how do you buy an airline ticket? And I say, I call the I just call the airline, that's all, because I like customer service and I like conversation. I think especially with texting, what I would observe just for me, maybe not for anybody else, is that there's a lot of talk going on in 140 characters or less, but I don't see a lot of conversation going on.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Judy, for your thoughts. I want to ask you a question. Is it fair to say that because you may be a little older and you actually remember the efficient time without cell phones or without in-home washer and dryers or without flat-screen TVs or without personal computers, that you're more adaptable to that versus the people who know nothing but that?
I would say that that's very true. I always try and keep in mind that I graduated from college 3 years before Microsoft became a public company. So it wasn't in school when I was in school. I did all of my papers and all of my research in the library and then typed them out on a typewriter. It just wasn't part of how I grew up. It wasn't part of being in school. It wasn't part of anything, and I haven't ever really seen the need to get involved in it. However, I will concede one thing that I do find particularly sad, and that is because all of my friends are on the computer and I am not. I realize I've fallen out of that loop of people. That's a struggle.
Certainly. And speaking of struggles, thank you very much, Judy, for your comments. Speaking of struggles, Austin tweets us at KCURCST. He's a prominent tweeter, a frequent tweeter for us. Thank you, Austin. He says, I want to give it all up, but how do I handle the fear of not having the money to start? I'm stuck in the trap. Many people call this the progress trap or the money trap. Talk about that trap that Austin is experiencing.
That's a very important point. One of the critical moves that we made early on after we lived with the Mennonites for a year and a half, we went back to Boston and worked like the devil for 2 years to save up a whole lot of money so that we could buy a property outright and get out of debt completely. And that turned out to be maybe our second smartest move after living with the Mennonites, because we've never had a mortgage. We don't have any real debt. I mean, we have a little debt that we accumulated to do household projects, but it's something that's very manageable. And so that's key. If you are in huge debt, you're going to be on the rabbit wheel. And it's hard. There's no other way to get out of it other than working, pedaling a little faster than the wheel is making you go.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Our guest is Eric Brindy. He's the author of the book Better Off, Flipping the Switch on Technology, a story and case study in irony, an MIT student who decided to live for a time without almost any modern technology. We got Josh in Overbrook, and if you want to comment, you can call in at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888, or email in at centralstandard@kcur.org. The question of the day is, what piece of technology would you give up that you think would make your life better? Josh in Overbrook, welcome.
Hey, morning, everyone.
So, good morning.
I live one of these lives that's half in the city, half in the country, and we do a lot of things different. But this time of year, the biggest technology that we've given up is your furnace, which costs a lot of money and makes life super convenient. And so we heat with wood and designed a little house around all of that. But it impacts the rhythm of our life in an awesome way, because we come home, we have to start a fire, talk about our days while we stand next to it and warm up, drink a glass of wine and start doing dishes and making dinner, listening to records. It just adds a certain element and structure, plus going out to get the wood, which connects you to, what's going on outside.
Thank you very much, Josh, for your contribution. It's not about actually harvesting ice and ponds out of lakes. Josh is not going that far, but he's going out, getting firewood, connecting to the land, chopping that firewood, letting the land feed him, throwing the fire in, and actually spending quality time. Talk about that.
Well, believe it or not, we in St. Louis, within sight of the arch, heat our house with wood, too. We have a wood-burning stove in our basement, and I love it. Once you get used to it, you can't go back, if only because wood-fired heat is so much more pleasant on the body than forced air heat, which just dries you up like a raisin. But everything you said is also true, that the rhythm, sitting by the fire, I have a feeling that what's happened in so many homes is that the television set has come, the flickering television set has come to replace the flickering hearth as the centerpiece of the family life. And we much prefer the flickering hearth.
What do you not miss about the Mennonite life on the farm? What could you do without as far as low tech? What do you not miss at all?
Well, that's a very good question. And now let me scratch my head, because it does take a little bit of thinking, because there were some things that I definitely do not miss about that way of life. I would say, one key thing was how to keep food fresh in the summer if you don't have an underground spring that you can set food in a bucket to keep it cold. So they, since they didn't allow electricity, that was their only option, unless they can keep their ice. And they did have an ice house. If there was enough ice during the winter, they would keep an ice house, but that wouldn't last them through the summer. I mean, that was only for special occasions.
But you did harvest ice out of the lakes and ponds. And
they did. I actually never joined them in that, but I watched them from a distance one time.
Did you reap the benefits of that by having ice cream in August?
As a guest in one of their homes, yes. Yeah, it was great. But we do have a small half-size refrigerator in St. Louis, so that's our one major appliance.
Jerry in Olathe, Kansas, welcome to Central Standard. Jerry? You're on, Jerry.
Oh, thank you very much. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
I wanted to make a comment concerning switching off of the grid.
Go ahead.
And my comment would be, or one of my hate things would be the microwave. The microwave oven, I think I would be able to give up without hesitation, because my oldest sister lives down in Springfield, Missouri, and every year around Thanksgiving and Christmas and the holidays, I go visit her, and she does not believe in microwave ovens. So she won't cook anything for me out of the old school, as they would say, and have a microwave to reheat it for me when I want leftovers. And I find that whenever she heats something up for me, she's using gas to heat it with, but whenever she goes back in and heats something up for me, the food tastes so much better than it does if I microwave it and pop it in my mouth, that instant gratification thing. That's one part. The other part is whenever she's doing that and reheating something using her gas oven, we're always communicating about something. It brings us closer together and gives us a time to share some of the things that we experienced in our childhoods, etc. So I think the microwave could be damaging to relationships and families, etc., much like television, of course, but microwave, a thing like that that we don't think too often about, it actually is a separator because, you know, you rush in, throw your food in, it's not good as it would be cooked in gas. And, you know, you don't spend time communicating with that other family member or spouse, significant other, whatever, because it's so quick. You're in and out of the kitchen without time to interact with each other. So
Jerry says, down with the microwave. What do you think about that, Eric Brindy?
Well, we don't have a microwave, and I would second that by saying that it's also very loud. It has a blower, so it's going to drown out conversation. And when you add that together with the blender, the mixer, the food processor, and all the other jingling things, that cacophony competes with human interaction terribly. And then, of course, the internet and everything else.
I think a jingling food processor might be pretty cool, just conceptually at least. Valerie in Leawood, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning. I'm thinking maybe a solution to this is to strike a balance. About 9 years ago, because I do love technology, but about 9 years ago, I had the opportunity to spend 9 weeks with my husband and three small children camping in New York and Connecticut. He was working for a Fortune 5 company, and they asked him to move to New York, just outside the city, but they weren't willing to give him a pay increase or provide moving expenses, and we were looking at each other like, how do you keep your job and still go up there? And, you know, and so what we did was we spent 9 weeks camping. And so he got up every morning, took a hot shower in the campground, put on his pressed shirt and tie, and no one had a clue that that's where he was spending the night. We went and bought this giant tent, and every day my six-year-old would get up and say, "Can I go fishing, Mom?" And he would walk, you know, 100 feet and go fishing. And my four-year-old learned how to ride a bicycle without training wheels, and my two-and-a-half-year-old saw more turtles than any two-year-old ever. And I really look back on that summer as my favorite summer of my life.
Thank you very much, Valerie. More turtles than any two-year-old ever. That's the experience of living in nature for our caller there. Valerie, talk about that, integrating your family into that type of lifestyle to create that type of consciousness. Because if you never know, you'll never go. Talk about that. You.
Oh, you said Valerie. Okay. Well, some of my fondest memories are of my kids. When we lived in a little town outside of St. Louis for a while before we moved into St. Louis, there was woods behind us. And just to see them going off into the woods, and they'd sometimes give me a tour of, they'd create little trails, and they created a cave. And they had no end of delight from their time in the woods. And those are their best memories when they talk about being in the woods.
One of our caller asked, Eric Brindy, about the smug attitude of these sort of hyper-intellectual urbanists wanting to live off the grid. She noted that it gives us a connection to our family and friends, our modern life. So how do you address the fact that even the people who live off the grid can and sometimes do use the benefits of our technological society? You can't go all the way. We did have a guest that did go all the way, Daniel Suelo, by the way. You can check that out on KCUR.org. He lives completely without money or much technology.
Wow.
But talk about that balance, achieving that balance.
Well, first of all, it's unavoidable. I mean, when people say, accuse you of saying, well, you use some of this technology that you're critical of. Well, the need, as I mentioned, the need for a lot of this is imposed on me and everybody else by the system or by our tradition. So definitely it's about striking a balance. Here's some of the ways that we strike a balance. And one I've already mentioned, that we don't have internet in the house, but we do have email accounts that we can access at the library. So it limits the time, so you don't have the phenomenon of 6 hours go by and whoops, and when you only went to look up one item. Another thing is that although we don't own a car, we do make occasional use of public transportation, and we occasionally rent a car for a trip for the family, and that's very convenient. I appreciate the use of that car. Let me think if I can think of... Oh, here's another one that might make you laugh a little bit. I went without a cell phone for a long time, but I discovered that it was really helpful as a rickshaw driver. That's one of the things I do to make money in St. Louis. I drive a rickshaw, and I serve patrons who go to big sporting events like the Cardinals or the Rams. And sometimes you get a customer who wants to come have you come back and pick them up, and without a cell phone, it's impossible to do. So I have my rickshaw cell phone, and I buy prepaid minutes and use them over the period of maybe 6 months or a year, and just keep the phone turned on for rickshaw service and leave a message directing people to my home phone number at other times.
Sean writes on Facebook that he can't live without AC or hot water, whereas Will on Facebook thinks he could do without the TV and radio. So everybody gives up a little bit at a time. Overall, Eric Brindy, do you think technology is providing its own destruction or the circuitry to hang itself, to paraphrase Karl Marx? And if so, what do you think happens to the modern human as this technology progresses?
You mean it's all leading us to self-destruction?
Self-destruction or imploding upon itself? Because as you point out in your book, technology also needs energy resources to keep it going.
Right. And it's really that technology is part of a larger system of industrial capitalism that needs growth to survive. There's this wonderful passage from Grapes of Wrath, John Steinbeck, where the banker's representative is trying to explain to this farmer that he's forcing out of his farm why they're taking over the farm. And he's saying, well, these big banks, in order to survive, they have to grow. They're like They're like one-celled animals. They have to keep getting bigger, getting bigger. And the problem is that that's not sustainable when the whole planet does it. It was sustainable for a while a few rich Western countries did it. But if everybody wants to live like us, and China especially, but all the other countries in the world, it's just do the math. It's just not going to work if for no other reason that we're going to denude the landscape and kill all the life forms. We're already killing off species at a rate somewhere between 10 and 40,000 species a year.
But I guess does technology aid in inorganic growth was the crux of the question.
Technology is key in that. Technology is the key factor that enables that, but it's part of a bigger system of industrial capitalism.
So how do we correct that?
Well, sad to say, usually capitalism corrects itself only after it goes through major crises like the 2008 banking collapse or the Great Depression, because most politicians don't have the willpower to make long-term decisions. They're looking in the short run. And any kinds of long-term decisions that are really going to help us are going to be painful in the short run. So nobody's willing to do that.
And until they are, won't be much change.
Right. And even under Obama, I have to say that he, with all the constraints he's under, he really has done very little to change the system as a whole.
Our guest is Eric Brindy, the author of the book Better Off, Flipping the Switch on Technology. He'll be at the Plaza Branch of the Casey Public Library at 6:30 p.m. at the Plaza Branch, talking about his book, Better Off, Flipping the Switch on Technology. Eric Brindy, thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me.
And tune in tomorrow for the movie critics as they gear up for Oscar season. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and executive produced by Bill Anderson. Kim Noble is our announcer. Emily Mutert manages our website. Central Standard's intro theme music is by Miles Bonney, and the outro is by The Wilnots. Up to Date is next with an examination of the Gay Dad Project plus the weekend to-do list. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and this is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.